From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Ron Paul's ideas are not new. He's been talking about ending the Federal Reserve and most federal departments for 36 years now. But over the last 5 or 6 years, his concept of revolution has really caught on. Thousands of enthusiastic supporters from surprisingly different backgrounds come to his events, and many thousands more supported his runs for president. Paul says there were lean times when he'd go to a campus and maybe 15 people would show up. Well, there were a lot more than that who showed up yesterday to see Congressman Paul at Utah Valley University. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Ron Paul, recorded on the campus there. We talked about his definition of liberty and his political career. Mostly we talked about his ideas, where they came from, and what he's expecting from them. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a profile of Ron Paul last year, the reporter Joel Achenbach wrote that the congressman doesn't have positions on issues so much as he has a philosophy. It's a philosophy about society and government that came to him decades ago, and it's built around his concept of liberty, which he's written about in a recent book. Above all else, he writes, liberty means keeping government out of our lives. So he's against the Federal Reserve. He's against the United Nations. He thinks most federal departments are unconstitutional, like energy and education and homeland security. He voted against the war in Iraq, but also against the Defense of Marriage Act. He's used to being the single vote against things. He told a reporter for Esquire magazine he generally won't vote for a bad bill, even though it has some good stuff in it. He said, once you say sometimes you have to give in a little bit, then you're never your own person. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Ron Paul, recorded on the campus of Utah Valley University. He joined us in the studio of the Computer Sciences Building to talk about his ideas and his philosophy about government and liberty. Ron Paul is a Republican congressman from Texas. He's serving his 12th term in Washington. He sits on both the Financial Services and Foreign Affairs Committees. Of course, he's made a number of bids for the Republican presidential nomination. Professionally, Ron Paul is a medical doctor who specializes in obstetrics and gynecology. He's the author of several books as well, including the one I mentioned, Liberty Defined. He's here as a guest of Utah Valley University and the Utah chapter of the Young President's Organization. That's a nonpartisan association of business executives. We're on the campus of the UVU. And Ron Paul, welcome. Thanks very much for being with
us. Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
I wanted to start. I'm not sure. I know you don't often talk about personal things, but I was, and I promise I won't spend too much time on this, but I did want to get a sense of what it was in your life that sort of brought you to the way you think. You and your four brothers were born during the Depression, a small dairy farm outside of Pittsburgh. And I'm wondering how just that experience in your life influenced the way you came to sort of think about things, the philosophy you came to think about.
I think it did, and I think family values do have an influence. Work ethics and behavior that way, I think, has a lot of influence. But I work on the theory that probably all of us are born with a basic instinct that we like to be our own person. I see this in the two-year-olds. You know, they like to exert their individuality. I think teenagers are pretty good at it, too. But then I think conventional wisdom, the people who get in charge, the people in charge of our educational system, or the people on television, the people in government, it seems like they want to show you that, you know, too much of that individualism, we have to crack down on it. The two-year-old can't be allowed to do anything he wants, and the teenager can't do anything he or she wants. But the big problem is where to draw that line and who does the restraining. I think it's very natural to want to be your own person. And the restraints, from my viewpoint, should be put on by the individual and the family and the friend and your friends and your neighbors and your church rather than the government. So it wasn't so much that there was a light bulb came on. It was that I think I had natural instincts that people wanted to take away from me.
Yeah.
And then I became a little confused on, you know, what is the truth about all this? And then I went searching, and it seemed like the more honest approach to this was found through economics for me, that why individualism and free markets and property rights was also beneficial, but it was based on, once again, individual liberty and making personal choices rather than a planned economy and a planned society and authoritarians being involved. So it wasn't, you know, overnight. It wasn't one switch. But then I tried to refine that and understand exactly how you solve problems if you truly believe in individual liberty. And I have done that for many years.
I read this story in the Washington Post. This reporter had noticed that when you were driving somewhere, you didn't wear a seatbelt. And you told him that you never have. And he had this, he sort of wondered, he said, is it because you just, is it comfort or that, and he wondered this, do you have this philosophical aversion to anyone meddling in your lives, anyone telling you to put on a helmet or put on a seatbelt? I was wondering what the answer was.
I mean, it's not a religious ritual. I mean, I probably just don't think about it.
Right.
And, so it's not sometimes when the person is sitting to the right of me, or if I'm in somebody else's car, you know, and you know, they want me to do it, it's no big deal. But I do resent the fact that I don't think there's a reason for a federal law to tell you to be safe. You know, why are they telling us this? Why don't they tell us what to eat? And they starting to do that too. I mean, the total Soviet type system, communist system, tells you how much exercise you get every day. You know, before you go to work, you have to do your calisthenics. So it's just authoritarianism. But from a personal viewpoint and from a medical viewpoint, I think seatbelts would probably make good sense.
Yeah.
But it comes up with a bicycle. People say, I ride a bike all the time, but I don't wear a helmet. I've been riding a bike since I was six. So why should I have to start wearing a helmet? Right. It's not as comfortable for me. And, you know, part of life is taking a risk, too.
Right. Right. Right.
So it's habits that you don't like being changed because somebody else thinks they know more about you than you know about yourself.
Why did you want to become a doctor? What did that have to do? Did that have anything to do with the way you were starting to think about the world?
Not a whole lot. When I started college, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I did better in science, so I started majoring in biology, and I was sort of undecided, and then I decided late in my college career. But I do remember thoughts going through my mind. In high school and college, I wasn't political. There were no political organizations, so I always compliment young people. Now they're way ahead of where I was when I was in college. But I was very very political when in college, when it came to a potential war over the Suez Canal, and Eisenhower squelched all that. And I thought, they're going to draft me. You know, I remember World War II, and I remember Korean War. Yeah. Here they go. They're going to have another war. So I was very happy that Eisenhower, you know, decided not to do it. But the other thing that had an influence, along with being a physician, was that I knew early on, again, I think it's a natural instinct. Why should anybody like war? But we're taught to be good patriots, and therefore we have to champion war and go get them and all of this. But my instinct stayed with me. I didn't like the war. I didn't like seeing family members going away and some not coming back and neighbors going away. And I thought that through, and I thought, even though I had not figured out foreign policy and didn't understand it, I knew I wasn't cut out to pick up a rifle and shoot somebody.
Yeah.
And therefore I thought, you know, I'll probably get drafted. I'm not going to shoot a gun. I think it'd be better if I just took care of people who got injured. And that was one of my motivations. It turned out I did get drafted later on.
The Vietnam War. Yeah.
And during the 60s. And by that time I was a physician and I got to be a flight surgeon. And it was a little bit different. I was not. That way it was a little bit of connection. But my whole philosophy, it wasn't worked out by that time.
Yeah. As I understand it, it was in medical school when you came in contact with some of the writing that would really be influential in your life. You read Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand, but also The Road to Serfdom, Friedrich Hayek's book. And this is where you started to encounter, at least as I understand it, the Austrian School of Economics. What was it that you were seeing in those books that started to now congeal in the way you were thinking about the world, the economic thing that you were mentioning?
I didn't think things were right, but I didn't know why.
Yeah.
My parents, even though I was born in the 30s, I didn't remember. I mean, you recall as a child on what you have, and there was a lot less. But the Depression really went on into World War II. You know, things weren't good, rationing and shortages and all. So I think it was curiosity to know how things worked and why people have good times and bad times. And I thought the answer's Hayek. He led me on to reading Mises. Yeah. And Murray Rothbard, and I got to meet most of the great Austrian economists of the 20th century.
Here's something you wrote in your book, Liberty Defined. You say that the Austrian school was the most robust defense of the economic system for the free society that's ever been made. And you say that it's more than just the advocacy or defense of free enterprise, that it's more than just an economic kind of defense. You see it in a bigger, broader way.
Yes. In the book that Mises wrote, it's called Human Action. And I always find that fascinating because, you know, in medicine, we're scientists and we deal with the human body scientifically. But there's also the emotions and the human actions of individuals, because you might know the diagnosis and give them the pills. The patient might not take them, or maybe they can't buy them. So there is a human action in medicine. And in economics, it's a challenge. The Austrians challenge the Keynesians. The Keynesians believe that if government does A, B, C, you get D, E, F, and you can predict it. And they have a mathematical formula that they say they can prove it. But turns out they're always wrong. And that was the discovery I had, that you cannot predict human action. You can predict trends, and you can predict certain things, and you know which way, which direction we're doing. We know about economic laws. But you, let's say we're all given a tax cut, and the Keynesians say, well, this is what's going to happen. It's going to create this many jobs or something. Well, maybe you'll decide to pay off debt. Maybe you'll save it. Maybe you'll buy a new car. Who knows what? So nobody can predict that. So there is a human element involved. And that, of course, is individuals. It's an individual choice. And we believe, of course, even Adam Smith believed this, you know, the invisible hand type of thing, that individuals making choices, they iron out the difficulties. It doesn't mean everything's going to be perfect. But when economic planners or government and bureaucrats and politicians do it, that's mischief. Individuals do it. They sort these things out, and they tend to make much better choices than when government bureaucrats do it.
You know, you talked about the fact that you thought that everyone has an instinct to sort of be an individual, an instinct for freedom. And I wondered, there's some sense, I think, when you, especially with Ayn Rand, you get some sense that she believes, and others in the Austrian school believe, that there's this producer class and then there's kind of a moocher class. There's a class a certain kind of class of people who are not, in fact, interested in making their own way, that are, you know, and it's reflected in, it seems to be anyway, in what Mitt Romney said about the 47%. And I wanted to get your take on that, because he talks about this 47% who, he said, I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives. Do you have any sympathy at all with what he said?
Yeah, a little bit. Let me first talk about the moocher class. I don't think it's class. I don't think this group are the moochers and these are the producers.
Right.
I think we're all producers and moochers. You know, I think we all would like to win the lottery. I mean, because I experienced that. You know, you hear that, oh, $20 million, that would be rather neat. It's somebody, and sometimes people say winning the lottery is winning a lawsuit. So I think what happens is the individual choice is eventually on us to become one or the other. And if somebody has a political philosophy to buy your vote by saying, you know, we have a grand wealth here in this country, I want your vote, so I'm going to teach you to be a moocher and you're going to be holding to me. And then that encourages. So it's a much more complicated thing. But the one thing I found interesting about the 47, it's a shame that it was done that way rather than a more academic setting, in a political setting that gets confusing. Because right now, what do we have? 46 million people on food stamps. So somebody has to work to take care of these people, and the numbers keep growing and growing. So the system isn't working very well. But the one part that wasn't brought up during that little conversation about the 47% might be a lot bigger, because they only counted I'm sure what he was thinking about and what most conservatives think about is, you know, the people who want to go on welfare and, you know, let the government, oh, they'll take care of my medical needs.
Yeah.
And they get tempted and they yield to it. But it turns out that corporations get twice as much from the government than do the poor people. So it's more of a universe. So it's within each and every one of us. We get to make the decision. But then I think it does get to be. I think the real moochers now are the ones who are getting contracts from the government and will build weapons that we don't need and go over and fight wars we shouldn't be fighting. I mean, that is a more deadly moocher class than somebody. I have much more empathy for people who lost their jobs because of a business cycle caused by the Federal Reserve, and they would take a job if they can, but if not, I'm going to take the welfare. Of course, they still lose their houses and their mortgages. So the system helped create that moocher class, and they forget about the moocher class of the very wealthy. So I look at that quite differently.
They wanted to ask you about something you said about Keynesian economics. You've been critical of John Maynard Keynes, of course, and you say in your book that Keynes gave the governments of the world a seemingly scientific rationale. This was something you were saying earlier, a seemingly scientific rationale for doing what governments – and this is how you put it – what governments wanted to do anyway. And that raised a question for me. What is that? What is it that governments want to do?
Well, there's a certain segment in society. Some people want to, you know, they yield to, you know, not taking care of themselves and minding their own business. But there's a certain group of people who like to tell others what to do, and they have no confidence in you and I maybe making our decisions. So the government has to be there to take care of them. So Keynesian, for those who want to wield authority over others, Keynesianism explains, well, it's good, it's necessary, it's a good way to run the world, it's a better way, you'll have more prosperity, and we, you know, all these, they try desperately to justify it. So Keynesianism sort of gives them the economic explanation on how you're going to pay for them to run our lives. But once again, I think we all have these choices. And some people yield to these temptations to be to be on the receiving end. Others like to take advantage of it and become more authoritarian. So this this whole idea that we're individuals and we have this responsibility, like I mentioned in the talk today, was, you know, if we're responsible for our eternity and our salvation, why can't we be responsible to put food on our plate? You know, and to me, knowing about free market economics, there's more food and more prosperity and a bigger middle class if you believe in it. To me, it's such a wonderful philosophy.
But I guess the question is government inherently bad then?
There's an inherent temptation for government to always get bad. Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely,
right.
Yes. Boy,
but you do see some essential functions necessary in a government, do you?
Yes, I'm not an anarchist.
Right.
You know, I believe it is, but not functions in the sense that they should tell you how to run your life and not to how to spend your money or run the economy, nor tell other countries how to live. But the government, and you know, the guide is pretty good. It's our Constitution. You know, they didn't set up a welfare state, and they were very adamantly opposed to overseas wars, and they didn't even want standing armies. And they said the best way to deal is stay out of entangling alliances, stay out of the internal affairs of other nations, be willing to talk to other countries, be friends with other countries, trade with other countries. It's great advice, and the Constitution only legalized a narrow viewpoint of government, and that is, you know, the amendments. It recognizes property rights. It recognizes contracts, sound money. But governments now, They don't protect contracts. They're always interfering with contracts. The contract is they should back our money with gold. So they're the counterfeiters. In a moral sense, they're committing counterfeit. At the same time, if you and I go out and start dealing in gold, people can get put in prison for this. So they've distorted it. So that is why the Constitution has to be very, very narrowly defined and held in check. But they recognized very clearly, the founders, Franklin and Adams, were very clear about this isn't going to work, you know, if the people yield to temptations and use government power. So the Constitution will only work with a moral people. They would expect more virtue. They expected more morality and more religious beliefs. Then their experiment, but indeed it was a major experiment. And I think the erosion came rather quickly, but the serious erosion of that concept occurred in the 20th century.
Is there a model you can think of a government, and kind of an ideal? And it doesn't have to be one that's current, but one maybe even in the past, one that's worked this out, one where all of these ideas have worked out reasonably
never
well?
Perfectly, and I don't think we ever will. Perfect authoritarianism, perfect communism doesn't work either.
Yeah.
So no, I don't think it ever has been. But I think a very good example is our own. You know, we had our problems, but De Tocqueville described America, you know, in the mid-1850s, I believe, when he came over and analyzed it. And hard-working, work ethic, family values, religious beliefs, and energetic and enterprising. And so it was a pretty good start, but then we drifted away from it. I have a lot of admiration for Switzerland, you know, because they don't fight wars. You know, they've won hundreds of years. They don't get involved in world wars. They've been able to stay out.
Yeah.
And they have their states, cantons, and they are very independent. They have quite a few different languages there. And I think the neatest part about Switzerland is I bet you there aren't very many Americans, because I try to remember who the president of Switzerland is, and I never can remember. Nobody knows. Probably the people in Switzerland know, because the president is so unimportant.
Right.
And I sort of think that would be pretty neat. Of course, sometimes I think our presidents deserve to be less important.
Congressman Ron Paul is with us, the Republican representative from Texas's 14th District, the author of the most recent book, Liberty Defined. And we need to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We continue our conversation with Ron Paul, recorded yesterday on the campus of Utah Valley University. Paul's commitment to limited government has earned him a passionate following, but also some suspicion among his colleagues in politics. We talked about his philosophy for an ideal society, which for him means as little need for government as possible. Congressman, you were talking earlier about Franklin and Adams. You're fond of Jefferson, too. Not as crazy about Alexander Hamilton. You've been critical of him for advocating the strong, centralized federal government. Pretty influential in that among his founding colleagues. And I'm wondering, do you think in some ways, because of his influence, which sort of made the Constitution, or at least made the structure of it a little bit more centralized, certainly than you like, is the Constitution flawed in some way in that sense?
Well, I think the people are flawed. The people who are in charge go to Washington, they're flawed because—
But the document himself, that's what I'm talking about. Do you think that's flawed? I mean, it was influenced by Hamilton.
No, I don't believe it's a perfect document. And a lot of people at that time didn't think it was a perfect document. And that's why I think Franklin and Adams put a lot of pressure on the people. So it's the people that compounds a document that didn't answer every single thing. I think it would be written differently today than it would be back then, but it might be written today in a much worse sense too. You know, they might try to say, well, we'll clarify this thing about the welfare state, or maybe we don't need the Second Amendment anymore. And right now we've gutted the First Amendment when you think about, searches without warrants and the Fourth Amendment, the privacy isn't there. So much of that has changed. But I think that it was very much recognized that Hamilton was in opposition to Jefferson. And one of their big disagreements had to do with the monetary system.
Right.
I mean, Hamilton believed in the central bank, and they had the first national bank, and Jefferson got rid of it eventually. So that argument, it was immediate. You know, this whole tug of war, you know, has been going on through all of history. It was just that the founders were hopeful that they would give us a much better system. They did give us a better system, but due to the various flaws,
it wasn't perfect.
It wasn't perfect, and of course, I think the real change has occurred since the progressive era of the 20th century.
You know, it's interesting. It's been said that under that form of government, if Hamilton hadn't, for example, been so influential, if there hadn't been so much focus on a centralized federal government, that the United States would have been more free, it would have been more peaceful, but it also would have been smaller, could have been poorer, could have been less powerful, less influential in the world. Would you have been okay with that?
No, because I don't think that would have happened. But you know what is interesting? If you go back and read Hamilton right now, actually he is not as bad as what we're doing. You know, he wrote a lot about the Constitution, and it's not all that bad. But in those times, he represented a more centralized government, the Federalists, and he challenged Jefferson. But so things have gotten much worse than Hamilton. But he opened the door. It just shows that struggle of trusting the people. This is amazing. There's some people that won't trust the people to make up all these decisions. But then they pick out a few people to go to Washington. They're still people, and they're going to make the decisions for everybody. Yeah. So it doesn't make any sense. The choice is do you want a few people making decisions for you, or do you want to make decisions for yourself?
But I guess
some people, like myself, I have a lot more trust in the people.
But I guess the question is the United States I guess this could be arguable, but reasonably considered as the superpower of the world. Is that the way it should be? Or should the United States be on a little bit more equal footing with some of the other countries? Does that make sense?
I don't like this idea of a superpower morally or militarily. Hmm. I like the founders talking about we don't need a standing army. This brings up the subject of American exceptionalism, which was sort of the thing that Woodrow Wilson started, the neoconservatives. We're such an exceptional nation. We're the superpower. We have to fill the vacuum. The Soviets were defeated, and therefore we have this responsibility. But I believe that we have some very, very good things about America and our Constitution, our early years, freedom and property and sound money. But the best way to deal with that is to practice what we preach, set a standard. And some did look at us early on. Some people still look at us, you know, as the good example.
Yeah.
But now we have to use force. We have to say, yes, we're going to give you the good democratic process. We're going to invade your country. We're going to sacrifice our young people. We're going to kill a lot of people. And we're going to have elections over there. I wish they'd be more concerned about fair elections in this country. But what my argument is, set a good example. And if you have a sound monetary system, prosperity, a large middle class, peace, then maybe they'll want to emulate us. That's my whole idea, is you do it through persuasion. Once you use force to say how great we are and we're going to be the powerhouse of the world, you've canceled out all your goodness.
Of course, one of the arguments you hear against some of your positions, Dr. Paul, is that they sound good in principle, but that they're not terribly practical. And I wanted to get you to respond to that idea that one thing that struck me, for example, you voted against sending any federal help to Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina. So in your ideal way of seeing it, the government shouldn't have been involved in that. But then you have the practical reality of people on rooftops, people thirsty and people hungry. How do you square your principle idea with the practical concept?
Well, overall, government fails. I mean, in my district, I've had the coastal district. I have like a couple hundred miles along the coast. We've been hit, and over many years, we've been hit with a lot of hurricanes. And they know I'm against FEMA.
Yeah.
But, you know, over the years, they've said, you know, Ron Paul's right about that. FEMA comes in, they take over in New Orleans. They came in and took over, and the police became corrupt. They took the guns from people. The volunteers couldn't come in. FEMA becomes a nemesis. And actually, it turns out I'm pretty practical because I believe in transitions. You know, that if the organization is there, I would go back for my constituents. You know, they come in, they take your money, you pay the insurance, and FEMA is a bureaucracy, and we'd work real hard. But, you know, the Red Cross couldn't get in, the police couldn't get in, the people who own their property, they can't get in, and they finally got sick and tired of it. It's not like if you didn't have FEMA, you didn't have anything. If you didn't have FEMA, you might have something much better, something like the way the country was taken care of for 200 years.
Which was how?
By local people, volunteers. I mean, there are
people taking care of themselves.
Matter of fact, you know, some of the people that arrived in New Orleans, some of the first people that arrived in New Orleans were the Mormons. And they even came on our property and they offered to help me on our property because we had some trees blown down. They were just looking to help. And that's only a taste of what could happen. You know, it would be just magnified if everybody had a lot more more money and it would be more efficient. But I, matter of fact, when that came up on that, see, right now, most of the welfare programs, I make the strongest case for protecting Social Security and Medicare because I say I'm not going to cut anything, even though philosophically I'm opposed to it and would work to get rid of it.
Right.
But what I say is save money from these wars. Enough to cut the deficit and tide people over who have become dependent. So I have a way to finance. If you keep spending this money and bring on a bankruptcy, nobody's going to have anything. So I'm very practical minded when it comes to a transition. But I'm also convinced it's not the most efficient way to do it. It's much better to allow local people do it. We've done it for so long. When I was growing up, we didn't have government medicine. And I don't remember any time that anybody, even when I first practiced medicine, the government wasn't involved, and I worked in a, you know, a religious hospital, and people never got turned away.
Well, this is what you said. You said that the idea that everyone has a right to medical care is an intellectual error.
Yeah, you have a right to your life. You have a right to your liberty. You have a right to work. You ought to have a right to keep what you earn. But you know, medical care is a service. Where are you going to get it? Oh, I'm just going to
but
go
it's a service
and force
so
you have to force somebody to do it. You have to have somebody with a gun. When you say you have a right to something, you have to send somebody with a gun to take it from somebody with the IRS and force them to pay for it. And then all of a sudden you say, well, this is just for 1% of the population. But right now we're up to 46 million people on food stamps. And it's going to bankrupt the country. And then those 46 million people and all the people on Social Security and getting Medicare, it's not going to work. And the system collapses. So, yes, we should work for a better system. There could be transition. But you cannot endorse, you know, endless welfare and endless warfare and think that you can finance it. And that's why we're marching toward a crisis much bigger than what we saw just a couple years ago in 08.
I hope this isn't too much of a diversion, but it did make me wonder about how you really thought about the role of government. I mean, you refused to vote to award congressional medals of honor to Ronald Reagan and Mother Teresa and Rosa Parks. So is that an abuse of government to do stuff like that? What was that about?
Well, you know what I did. It wasn't much money. It was like $45,000 or something.
So it was the money issue.
Oh, well, what right do I have to take your money? What if you don't like Ronald Reagan? What if you think he's the worst president ever? Why should I take even a nickel from you? You know what I did, though? When they were doing one, I think it was Cardinal O'Connor. Somebody accused me because I wouldn't vote for a gold medal for him. He said, oh, you're anti-Catholic. That's what your problem is. And I said, look, if you want a medal for the Cardinal, I said, I'll put down $100. Everybody put in $100, and we'll give it to them. It's our money. But people need to read the story by Davy Crockett, Not Yours to Give, because he made a big point of this, because one of his constituents, he had voted for something like that, and so one of his constituents says, that's not your money to give. That's my money. So Not Yours to Give by Davy Crockett is a fantastic little story. And, of course, that was a long time before the Progressive era stepped in. No, it's the principle of the thing.
Yeah.
It's the money. It's the authority. If you can disobey the Constitution on little things, you can disobey it to the point where you can allow presidents to arrest American citizens without charges and put them in prison indefinitely and have no trial. That's why I don't like incrementalism.
Yeah. You've served in Congress for 12 terms now. You're not going to run again. But what did you think? Do you think that's too long? We had this conversation with Orrin Hatch earlier. He's been in office coming up on 36 years. He's running for his seventh term, six-year term. Is that something you feel did you compromise a principle on staying so long, or did you think that was fine? I mean, what was the intent, do you think, of the founders for in terms of
the law
of
the land, the Constitution? You have to change the Constitution
right.
If you're going to change it. The Constitution.
But forget the law. What's the intent?
Okay. When the Republicans took over in the 1990s, I went back in. I was there 6-7 years, and I went back home and I practiced medicine. And when I went back, the Republicans took over the House, and I think they had the Senate at this time too. So we voted on about 8 different term limitation bills, and I voted for all of them. In the early 70s, before anybody was talking about it, I introduced a bill for term limits, but I'm not very excited about it. You know, I voted for it. I think it's it. You need to change the – because it's very, very secondary to what I'm talking about.
To the real problem, you see. Yeah,
because some of the best people who did voluntary term limits, you know, some would sign this document and say, oh, I'm going to stay 6 years. Well, the unprincipled ones would sign it and then stay anyway. Some who were principled were my closest allies. They were the best people. And they, the individual who replaced them, they came in, and they were big government people. So, no, it isn't a solution. It's the philosophy of government that the people hold. It's the people endorse runaway welfare and endless wars and funny money. Who's there doesn't matter. So I sort of admired John Quincy Adams. After he was president, he went back to the Congress and stayed for a long time. But he also introduced a resolution every Congress to stop slavery, you know, and I always admired him for that. You know, today, can you imagine a president now retiring and going to the U.S. House of Representatives? No, but no, I don't think that's it, but it is a mess. And I thought anything that would shake up the Congress like term limits, I'd support it.
Dr. Ron Paul is with us, Republican congressman from the 14th District of Texas, author of the book Liberty Defined. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Congressman Ron Paul. He was with us yesterday on the campus of Utah Valley University. I want to ask you about some social issues. You're a conservative Christian. Do you ever find any conflicts with your conservative Christian values and your libertarian ideals? You ever see those in conflict ever?
Mm-mm. No way. Because There's no conflict with libertarianism, freedom. Matter of fact, they come together because libertarianism means that all the responsibility falls on the individual, whether it's your physical responsibility, your social responsibilities, or your spiritual responsibility. And that's what libertarian is all about, the idea that the individual has the responsibility and that person has free will to go one way or the other. Some people think that is the case because some who call themselves libertarians take their freedom and they abuse it and they do things that aren't very Christian. And the hang up there is that when you endorse liberty, a lot of conservatives don't want to endorse total liberty because people might go out and smoke marijuana, you know, and commit the ultimate sin, you know. So when you legalize freedom, you don't endorse what people do. Because I legalize freedom of choice in religion, you legalize atheism. So I don't endorse atheism. There's a lot of religions I don't endorse either.
Yeah.
But we're pretty good in this country, you know, in protecting people's freedom of choice. I want people to know that legalizing something doesn't mean you endorse people how they use their liberty as long as they don't hurt anybody else.
But is it Christian? Because it was interesting. You write in Liberty Defined, there's a little passage you have, a chapter about marriage. Is it unchristian to deprive a group of people, gay people, from their ability to get married? It's a big issue here
That would be wrong to deny that. No, but I don't even think the government should be involved. I don't want the government making the definition. I want the state out. There was a time when you got married. Matter of fact, I was innocent enough when I got married in 1957. What's this license business? We're going to the church to get married. Now, why is the local state government or the federal government have anything to say about it? That would solve all these problems, all this fighting on who's married and who's not married.
Well, let me read what you said, wrote in your book. You said, in economics, licensing is designed by the special interest to suppress competition. Licensing for social reasons reflects the intolerant person's desire to mold other people's behavior to their standard.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people like to write laws about, and I don't believe in those kind of laws to suppress people.
And that's what you think about for a marriage license. That's being used by intolerant people to suppress others.
I want people to make up their own minds about it. You know, I happen to personally know that probably as long as dictionaries have been written, what the definition is of marriage. But if somebody wants to come along here, I'm not going to write a law and say that, well, I've just decided that marriage is something different than what the dictionary says. Am I going to write a federal law and put them in prison or write regulations on them? They've made their choices. It's a free society. You have free will. If it's good or bad, that's somebody else to decide. But people shouldn't be trying to set moral standards. The only moral standard is to repel and prohibit violence. Mm. I mean, that's one. That's the moral basis of libertarianism, that you can't hurt other people. You can't take their property. And if you make a promise, which would be very much Christian, if you make a promise, you fulfill your promises. And that means contracts. And government has authority. A lot of people accuse us, or me in particular, oh, you want chaos. You're not voting for Dodd-Frank and all of these regulations. And we have to save the people from these crooked rich bankers. Of course, they don't deal with the Federal Reserve. But the libertarian position is stricter, because what would have happened in the crisis when everybody was going bankrupt? There'd have been no bailouts. You wouldn't have bailed out the rich people. Bankruptcy is the law of the land. Matter of fact, it happens to be a national law too.
Yeah.
Because they thought it should be a national law. So yes, if you defraud somebody, our government now is notorious for changing the contracts. You know, interfering, telling you who to hire, who to fire, how much to pay, and all these things. They don't let the market work. So the market is very, very strict. It's probably a lot stricter. When it becomes the government, then it becomes political,
yeah.
You know, and whoever has the political clout. So then that it gives you the incentives. For the richer you are, the more influence you have. And yeah, we'll throw crumbs to the poor, but we're going to get the big bucks. We're going to – the lender of last resort will take care of us, but it won't take care of the little guy.
Well, let me get back to that question of violence, because I think this is – we need to take a break here in a moment. But it gets to this – your position on abortion, which is – this is one – a question, it seems like, of violence for you. You write about this in your book. And you mentioned that the Hippocratic Oath used to include a pledge not to do abortions. It's been changed. You think it should go back that way, that doctors should pledge not to do abortions?
I think whatever the doctor wants to do, he can take any pledge he wants. There was never a law that people – it was tradition that
right.
had the Hippocratic Oath, but traditions had changed. And it always said that you couldn't take up an instrument of abortion. And so it was – that's what in Greek times, how many thousand years ago, they believed in this. But then it came along, and They just dropped it when I graduated from medical school. Yeah. I remember when my son Rand was graduating, I went to his graduation, and they brought it back in. I thought, oh, this will be interesting. I'm going to find out what they say about abortion. And they changed it, and they said that you just couldn't do anything illegal. So whether abortion was good or bad became irrelevant. If the government became the superior being, you know, of setting the standards, if the government says it's okay to kill the fetus and it's okay. But back again to what our government says now is that our president can assassinate American citizens and the military can arrest us. So is our truths relative? You know, and that's the fault of the government, you know, doing this and us allowing them to do it. No, I consider killing a fetus an act of aggression, right. Killing a human being.
Right. Well, that gets back to the question, though, that, again, seems like you've got this conflict with a principle and a conflict. Let's say you have a 16-year-old girl who's raped by her uncle. Do you make her have that baby? What, and if a doctor performs that abortion, is that an unethical act in principle? I mean, there's conflict.
There's no doubt it is difficult, but that isn't the reason the discussion is on hand. They use that example as where the debate ought to be.
Yeah.
But the debate is abortion on demand, just any time, every time, and the Supreme Court says.
But that's the other extreme.
Even in the third trimester, you know.
Yes.
That is the case. No, it's very difficult. I've seen cases like this. First thing is, it's not a federal function. The federal government is way too much involved. They make it more complex. One of the most controversial, difficult subjects to deal with would be, you know, a rape victim. So the federal government should be out. But just think of how strongly some people in this country feel about abortion. Can you imagine the stupidity of the people who like abortion taxing those people, taking the money from pro-life people and using it to do abortions on demand? It makes no sense. That's why we're clawing each other. The founders were right. The more difficult the problem, the more local it should be. So I'd get the federal government out, never finance abortion. And then different states would do different things. I think it's still killing, but it's not like somebody is robbing a 7-Eleven and there's somebody on the floor and they shoot the guy in the head. I mean, outright vicious murder. Mm. If a woman is raped, and it is difficult to get immediate treatment, but the truth is, if a woman is raped and she goes to the emergency room and gets some treatment, the pregnancy will be prevented. It would be a purely personal moral decision, because what you're doing there in that very, very early stage is a personal decision. There's no medical proof of anything. There obviously could never be any legal proof of a crime.
So that's not killing a – life doesn't begin at conception then.
It's a difficult era. Yeah. But I'm not the one to write at least a federal law to say that you can't take a birth control pill 1 hour after you've been raped. I mean, it's a personal moral decision. And to me, sorting this out, you know, the difficult at the early stages, that isn't nearly as important as recognizing life. Because how can I defend in detail liberty for people to make bad mistakes if I don't defend all life? So this is one place where it's not going to be perfect, but there was abortions done before Roe versus Wade and before they were defying the law. And if it was a medical problem and my mother might die and this sort of thing, but they'd have two or three doctors do these consults. And to me, it said at least, well, this is something very important that we're doing. But abortion on demand anytime, if life is not valuable, how can liberty be valuable? And I think there's a correlation between the common use of abortions from the 1970s on with the careless attitude about children. You know, if the child is worth nothing before birth, why is it worth so much afterwards? That has to be dealt with if you really want to talk about life and liberty and morality.
I want to ask you what you think about the condition of today's Republican Party. Here's something you told the reporter John Richardson. You said the party was once home, or the conservatism anyway, was once home to distinguished intellectuals and men of letters. It now tolerates and even encourages anti-intellectualism and jingoism that would have embarrassed earlier generations of conservative thinkers. With that in mind, what do you think of the modern Republican Party? And let me ask you this. Are you going to vote for Mitt Romney for president?
Well, I'm not going to answer the second one because I'm not going to give you an affirmative.
Why? You don't want to say who you're going to vote for?
Because I think people should make up their own minds.
Okay.
I shouldn't tell people anything.
Fine. The question was, do you worry about the modern Republican Party, the party
yeah,
as
it
is now?
I have an answer for that.
Good.
I don't lose any sleep worrying about the party. But I do think a lot about and I try to change things because I don't think there is a two-party system. I think we have a one-party system because nothing ever changes. Rhetoric is different, slightly different here and there. But when it comes to foreign policy, you know, we've been taught for years, never challenge foreign policy. If you're in war, you're not supposed to, everybody has to mark lockstep and be partisan support, whatever. So there's a support for war, there's support for spending, and the two get together. Some want to spend here, the others here, and they get together and they both agree to spend the money. And I find it rather ironic that we go overseas to spread democracy and we die and spend a lot of money. And I don't think we have a good democratic process here. If you want to run as a third party candidate, how many are in the debates these days? Two. And who runs the debates? Republicans and Democrats. And who sets all the rules? This little commission. So what if you're in a third party and you want to build it? How do you get on ballots? You spend half your money. I spent more than half my money in 1988 just trying to get on ballots. And so get in a debate. You think I'd have gotten any attention for these views if I'd have tried to do it outside the Republican Party? The system is very, very slanted against it. So I don't signal out the Republican Party. I signal out the system. And somebody asked me whether I thought it was time to have a third party. I said it was time to have a second party is what we need.
We're pretty much out of time. Let me ask you this. I was curious. I heard that you love to garden. Is that true?
That is true.
Do you think you're going to have time to do a little bit more of that in the coming years?
I've always been able, even as busy as I was, I would I usually tried to get – I got home every on weekends. I try to get my Sundays at home. And I would get my work in, but it's not like it's a super, super big garden. But always, I've been for as long as I can remember, raised tomatoes. But I, in the north, in a temperate climate, you could raise more vegetables and fruits than I can in that very, very hot climate down in Houston. But I do experiment a lot with tomatoes and other small things like that. But I have a lot of fun. It gets me outdoors. There's nothing better than eating a fresh tomato off the vine versus those that are from a greenhouse and ripen off the vine. So I'm sort of sympathetic to that.
Dr. Ron Paul, the Republican congressman from Texas, author of several books, among them Liberty Defined. And Dr. Paul, thank you very much for
You're
being
welcome.
With us.
Nice to be here.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Matthew Browning of the Young Presidents Organization and Aaron Haskell, also Will McKinnon of Utah Valley University. The show mixed today by KUER's engineer Lewis Downey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.